right.
Please take care.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. So, okay. Well, one thing I wanted to say about the Metta Sutta, there is this, we have to make these compromises in the translation, but I ask a little bit around with the Pali experts, and there is not this, in Pali you don't have this, what is it? What is the term? The should, there is no should in it. Huh? So, and is not what should be done. Well, there are no shoulds in Buddhism, actually. It's basically that is one does what one does who is skilled in goodness. Huh? And to know the path of peace, and then not let them be able and upright, they're gonna be able and upright. Huh? So there is this is the way you have to be. It's more basically this is the way it is when that is achieved. Actually, that is when you have loving kindness, that is the state of mind. Huh? So it's not only an aspiration. It's more also a state of being of that the mind with loving kindness. And sometimes it can be important to make sure you understand this. These are translations, and these are we're trying to express something in language which is something that is often on a feeling level, or sometimes speech can be just an approximation to what is said there. And if we hang on too strongly on a word, this is what should I do, or and I'm not doing this and I'm not doing that, we can get into this conflict again with ourselves, and that is the opposite then of loving kindness. So that about the Metta Sutta and a little bit about the translations. Make sure you try to grasp the essence of it, and if it strikes to be harsh or demanding, then it's not the nature of what is told by the Buddha. Always has to be that gentleness there and the goodwill in your mind, and that you please try to take that with you always in your meditation as well. When we start the meditation, in a few minutes, there's nothing that should be done. There's nothing that has to be any other way. It's all a measure of awareness that we have for what is going on in our minds, in our body, in our feeling, in our perception. So the aim is definitely to become a little bit calmer in our minds, to see a little bit deeper. But that is the goal, to see a little bit deeper, and the calmness is the tool for that. If we in this constant thought process, it just makes it very hard to see what is going on, because the thoughts are never in the moment. The thoughts are always somewhere in the past, trying to figure something out or thinking what might happen in the future. So there's, if the meditation gets a bit deeper when that the thought process has stopped a little bit, and then it starts again, it feels a little bit like you're dragging this heavy iron ball, you know, in the old prison movies when they had the this chain with this huge iron ball on their leg that they couldn't move very far, and that's how it feels. As the thoughts, they are, in a way, they seem to be incredibly fast, and sometimes it's just they're so fast they can drive us out of our minds. But compared to the awareness, to that what is going on without thought, the thoughts are incredibly slow. So when the thought process starts again, it feels like you're dragging this iron ball behind you, and as always is this drag, and it's too slow, and it's just heavy. And that I find is a nice simile, because it's not about to stop thinking. It's this realization what a burden this constant train of thought really is. And the more the mind realizes what a burden thoughts can be, the more it is inclined to become stiller and to listen into this stillness. And then there don't need to be anybody in the background who tells the mind to be still and what to do. It's the mind's getting interested in this what is more pleasant. And what is more pleasant is when it pays attention to these thoughts slowing down and other sensations coming up. So to do that, obviously the mind needs that interest. And I always, when people talk about energy in Buddhism, is for me coupled with interest. When they talk about kindness, it's interest. When somebody has interest in us, it's a nice feeling, isn't it? Somebody is interested in what we're doing. Basically, it gives us this feeling of there's some sort of importance to what we're doing. And so having this interest in this becoming more still and seeing this this incredible stream of perception running by without thought, without our interference, is it needs this kind interest. Without that, we go back to the old process, to the thoughts, to the speculations, to the anticipations, or to the complaints. But with this little bit of kind interest, it becomes something valuable. It becomes something that is that there needs to be no effort doing that, because if we're interested, the mind is glued to that what is going on, and that is a nice way of slowing the thought process down, just by shifting that interest into. Can be a part of your body, can be just the whole sensation, the whole experience of sitting there with closed eyes and just giving the mind the instruction not to think so much and seeing what's happening. And then if we want to, we can use an object, because sometimes then the mind fiddles around too much and doesn't really know where to go. It's in the legs, and then it's in the somewhere in the chest with the breath, and then it's behind the eyes, and then there's a sound coming in, and then there's an itch in the neck, and then there's a thought coming up. So it is still is a lot of too much going on. The feeling is just of too muchness, and then we can always offer the mind the breath, because I personally like the breathing meditation very much, because it's something that the body does without our interference. It doesn't need us to breathe. So our reptile brain is doing all the work. And when we put our effort into it, or we put our attention, no, sorry, not effort, if we put our attention onto it, then we interfere with it automatically, and that's totally normal. And then we need this kind interest of, how much can I take away from this? I don't have to do anything with the breath. It can just go however it wants. And then there can come the point where it's just the body is just breathing, and it's effortless. And when there's as effort involved again, there's something that is that we want, or that we don't want, and then we might have to put a little bit more kindness in that what is going on again. Now, please never use any methods that are harsh for your mind, and put your mind in the corner. I don't like that personally. I don't see great results with that. It needs this trust. Letting go needs a lot of trust. So the mind needs to trust that what we're doing with it, we have the best intentions for it. And it really has to believe that, otherwise we can't let go. If there's still mistrust to our own goodwill, then if something happens, it's only going to be fearful. Fear is going to come up. And we destroy something that can get very beautiful. But if that trust is there, if that goodwill is there, we just stay with the goodwill for the whole process. And that doesn't need any interference if the mind is used to that. If we're treating ourselves nicely for a long time, then there is no there's not so much doubt coming up in the mind. Do you really mean it? Do you really? Yeah, I do. All the best for you. So that can happen when the meditation gets a little bit deeper. And if you start from the very beginning with a lot of goodwill for your own mind, you can avoid all this fear stuff coming up in your meditation. Okay, so I'm gonna talk a little bit into the meditation now. If you want to make yourself comfortable, I'm gonna meditate for half an hour like always. And like you see, I'm sitting here cross-legged. I hope you have your comfortable position at home. Some position where you know you can spend a certain amount of time in that position with not damaging the body. And where from the very beginning you can relax the body. Because if we hold tension from the very beginning in the body, it's very hard to... It's basically the tension in the body is very connected to what is happening in the mind. So it can help tremendously if we manage to get the body relaxed, get the body comfortable as we can. And you don't have your cameras on, a lot of you, so you can lie down or be on your special meditation chair or whatever you want to do. Make it nice. And then I go through my body, go through my feet, wriggle my feet a little bit, see if they're not squeezed in somehow. My legs and hips. And then I always, because I'm sitting upright here, I always use my breath. Just I pump myself up a little bit with air and then I let it out. And then my shoulders and neck are in a very comfortable position already. And I also figured out if I have enough room for my belly to go outwards if it wants to. And I do that a few times and then my shoulders come down a little bit more. I check my hands in my position. They're close enough to the body and comfortable that they don't have weight on my shoulders. And then I check my face. And if we do that right, and you're not in some sort of chronic pain that we can't do anything about, then that's a good starting point. Which is this, you're sitting as comfy as you can. Don't have to hold on to anything, the shoulders are relaxed. The forehead is relaxed, so we don't have to think that much. Now we can get interested. What is happening if I don't think so much? What happens if past and future become irrelevant for this half hour? What happens if I do not have to analyze? If I do not have to judge? How pleasant is that? if I don't have to think anything at all. And just have a look where the perception goes. How it wanders through the body. Maybe some noise experience, maybe a smell. We don't need it to be anywhere in particular yet. Remember that little bit of goodwill, this little bit of interest, not getting anywhere, just what's happening. And with that little bit of kind interest, even if it's not completely pleasant, can just see how that comes up and goes as well, out of our control. And if you feel more comfortable with a direction already, then you can pick up your meditation object, whatever you like. But if you do that, just do it with the same kindness and gentleness, with the same interest, with this looking what is going on there, and looking deeper and deeper. Even if it's nothing special. There's only a few minutes left now. Last chance in this meditation, having a look. Where's the mind? Lots of thoughts. Or is it nice and calm? No judgment, just figuring out . So I'm gonna ring the bell 3 times, and then please, after the last ring, open your eyes and we end the meditation for tonight. I hope the dong was loud enough. So, I hope you had a good time. I'm sitting with my back to Ajahn Brahm's wall. I had a nice meditation. Soaking up the energy here. This is the Mahatera hut, so that is the room adjacent to Ajahn Brahm's. It was very nice. Do we have any questions? Do we have a question box here, or how does that work? Rachel.
We have a chat box, Ajahn, but I don't think there's anything in it. I'll have a look. And people can also switch on their microphones and ask questions.
Okay.
There's no questions in the chat box. Would anyone like to make a comment or ask a question? Are you all too chilled out?
Well, then I have to come up with something myself, I guess. That's always the hardest. Well, for me, the meditation makes that aspect of Buddhism, this non-self, always a lot clearer. If we learn watching what is going on, then it becomes so obvious how out of control everything is. Huh? We have this limited control. We can close our eyes, and then not even then can we decide if the mind goes behind the eyes, and maybe we still see the dark shadows, or if you have lights in your room, you see something through your eyelids. Cannot influence the sound. We cannot close our ears. And then the feelings, the sensations in the body just going on and on and on. And if we actively take part and see if we can slow down the thought processes, becomes so obvious that even the thing we associate of, I mean, maybe men more than women, I don't know, but I cannot speak for the women, but I think most men associate themselves very much with their thought process, huh? with their intellect. And then in the meditation we see how limited that power over this thought process is, huh? this rambling on. And if you have a good attitude towards your mind, you can try things like shut up for 1 minute, shut up, mind. And it's so interesting, even often in that minute, something comes up again. Huh? Who the hell is talking the whole time? And that's, I mean, has nothing to do with being schizophrenic, and it's not another word, another voice in the head or anything. It's just this. We add this sense of self towards the thought process. Huh? And if we look what is really going on, can still that, how can that be myself? It doesn't even do for 1 minute what I want it to do. Huh? So, but then we take all the ideas and the guilt and the praise and all the stuff that comes into the mind, we all take that for granted and we all take that on. Huh? Oh, Jita Paolo, that was such a great talk. Oh, you helped me such a lot, actually. Blah, 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 actually. And that somehow actually blows my ego up. And then something tells me, oh, what a horrible bullshit, actually. I don't want to listen to that. I'm leaving the Buddhist society. My donations are cancelled. And then one takes that stuff on, actually. Where is that coming from? I don't even have that control over my own mind. How can I trust your minds? That's just madness, actually, isn't it? And this is the same with other perceptions as well, with the feelings, you know. We cannot for a few seconds control what we feel in the body. Or sometimes when we have a strong emotion coming up, it can last a little bit longer, but even there are fluctuations in that. Hmm? Strong sense of well-being, of meaning well, or a strong sense of anger or hatred or whatever coming up. That sometimes can seem to last. Or a strong sense of depression or whatnot, this awful feeling of, I don't know, because I never was depressed, actually. I just maybe know a little bit of melancholy or whatnot, huh? that feeling, but that is very strongly involved with the thought process. So I usually can cut through that very quickly. Huh? When I see my mind going in a direction like that, it's sort of have been there, have done that. doesn't do anything good, so basically for me it's easier to let go of that. But I take other things as real. Huh? I take other feelings as real, huh? Sort of aversions and anger. But only usually the unpleasant emotion I have a stronger grip now after a few years on. I see quicker when the mind is going in that direction. And then I just had a discussion with somebody this morning, and I also noticed if we hold a grudge towards somebody, huh, it's really holding something. Huh? If we don't think about the person and we don't think about the action, not confronted with it, and we don't chew on it again and again and again, it dissipates. Huh? So if we if we try to hold that up, that feeling of holding a grudge, or for some people even revenge or whatnot, yeah, it's not that it's constantly there. It's that they have to bring it up over and over again. Yeah? Find the negativity there. Find the cause and give it realness. That process in the mind through thoughts again. And then the funny thing is, if we don't do that, the grudge is just fading away without effort. And that is good to know, because it's painful. Huh? Holding on to something like that is just it's hard work. Huh? And the funny thing is, and we often believe it's doing us something good and it's important, but it's just from a point of meditation, when we get a little bit of the feeling of what letting go is, we see, wow, holding on to something like that is exhausting, huh? Painful, exhausting. And so instead of getting confused and trying to regulate that mind, trying to manipulate that mind in all sorts of ways, I find it more helpful if we try to see as clearly as we can. If we get angry with somebody, then in that moment we don't see clearly, obviously. The stronger the anger is, the harder it is to see what is going on. And then I give it a little bit of time. I allow myself that anger. I try not to shout at people usually, but I have the feelings coming up. And then it's just, yeah, it's there. And if I don't hold on to that, if I don't proliferate about it, justify it, it's sort of, yeah, like the sinus curve again, you know, it's just fading, it's just going down all by itself again. And then later on I try to contemplate and see, is that pleasant or unpleasant? Is that good for me? Is that good for the other person? And then, no, it's unpleasant. And it doesn't paralyze me so much anymore. That is a sort of, I have to be the good Buddhist or whatnot. It's sort of these things come up and they go again, and it doesn't paralyze me in that way that I cannot say anything anymore if I don't like things that people do. Because I find that very unhealthy as well, trying to be better than I am. And after 20 years, I'm not that great yet. It's just the way it is. But it's, I mean, that beautiful non-self aspect is there for me. If it was up to me, I would be awakened already. Huh? It's just there's not a button there in front of me that I can press and choose to press actually, and things are happening. Huh? I have to work with that mind as good as I can, and whatever is happening with it is not up to me. And that is for me the beauty in that teaching. Instead of guilt and original sin or I don't know what, is that process rolling on, and in that process there's just in the nature of that process there's a lot of suffering involved. If we want it or not, we cannot control that process in a way that there won't be any suffering for us. And it's actually the opposite. The more we try to control that process, the more suffering we have in that process rolling on. I mean, we learn as children that, I don't know, we pack a warm jacket when we go somewhere because in the evening it's gonna get cold. So we save ourselves that suffering from sitting there in the evening and being cold. That is the wisdom or whatnot that we maybe gained from having the experience of coldness and taking that burden of an extra jacket even when it's still hot, because we know it's gonna be cold at that time. So we're planning for the future, and that in intelligence of avoiding that suffering in the future can delude us into that thinking that we control everything in the future. And then, yes, and I take my lunch with me as well, and then I take my mosquito repellent with me as well. And then maybe I need another pair of shoes and another dress and I don't know, my cream. And this might happen and that might happen, and then we're having a backpack already on our back actually, and wandering around with that, actually just trying to prevent something that's gonna happen in the future again. Huh? So getting this balance of not being stupid, just we're not walking into the fire, and because we need to figure out what is going on in there, we know it's gonna hot and it's gonna burn us already. But also not becoming this anxious people that has to be in place and that has to be in place, and that and people can become so limited with that, you know, they think they're creating a safe heaven for themselves, but in reality, it's Pink Floyd building your wall, building up your wall around you actually, and you're prisoner in that thing, and it's not even a wall. It's basically it's more really this backpack that you carry around with yourself, or maybe a wall that you have to carry in that round thing, huh? And it's just heavy and nothing gets through anymore. And so developing a little bit of this wisdom of the middle way, we don't have to be anything different. This is not what should be done when one is skilled in goodness and who knows the paths of peace. This is the happiness of loving kindness. This is what's happening when there's loving kindness. That is the path of peace. That is when you are able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. These are all results of that state of mind of loving kindness. Huh? So there is not another should in the background. And I find that dangerous, because people try to be often something that they are not when they're Buddhists. Huh? They try to be a lot more holy than they are, and sometimes it becomes incredibly fake, huh? and is really tiring and just another burden. You know, and it doesn't taste real, and it doesn't taste like freedom or anything. Huh? It just tastes like another mask you have to put on. Now I'm the kind Buddhist, and I light my incense and everything is so holy, and my bells and hallelujah actually. But it's this process of the mind realizing what is happiness, what is suffering. And if the mind can't see clearly what is happening and what is suffering, we're gonna engage in more suffering. We're gonna, if we don't see that anger is not worth a pat on the shoulder, and you're defending yourself and you're pushing yourself to success and whatnot. If you can't see that is suffering, that is basically just leading to sore elbows, people disliking you, and you're not liking yourself anymore, not trusting yourself anymore, because you're an asshole, and if you're an asshole, you're an asshole actually. It's just like, and it's not just for other people, it's for yourself as well. You cannot be an asshole to everybody else and are completely delighted in your own mind. It just doesn't work that way. If you either have a mind where there's some beauty developed, and where it's genuine, or it isn't. And if it isn't there yet, then it isn't, because it's not self. That is not what should be done. It's basically that experience of loving kindness is exactly what happens then. Then in that moment or after that meditation, you're going to be incredibly kind. You're going to be incredibly open. Yeah? It's just our usual behavior seems to be sort of steps below. Yeah? And that is the experience of the, if it's loving kindness or compassion or goodwill, anything in that direction in your meditation, when it goes a little bit deeper, is always a feeling of more safety, a feeling of more doubt decreases, because even if somebody else tells you, oh, that is not real, who cares what they think? Yeah? It's so bloody real. Nobody else, who's deciding what is reality there or not? Huh? Sure, if realness is defined by that it's not lasting, I know. Huh? We also have impermanence in Buddhism. Huh? If it's the highest mind states, my connection is unstable, do you still hear me? Show of hands. Hello? Do you hear me? Okay, good. it's gonna fade. Huh? The mind state is gonna fade away, and with my most awful mind states, it's gonna fade away if I don't hang on to it. Huh? And that is what non-self is for me. I mean, the realization, obviously, of really seeing how deep that whole process goes, was one of the enlightenment or awakening experiences of the Buddha. Huh? So we're just scratching the surface there, but just on that path and on that reflection towards it, I find there's a lot of beauty there. The way Ajahn Brahm was the first few years here was non-self, 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 non-self the whole time, but also the beauty of it. Huh? It was not you should give this up and you should give that up, because it's if you hold on to that stuff, actually you're holding on to a self, and you're still addicted to this and you're still addicted to that, and that has to go and that has to go, because that is all part of your ego actually. And if you want to see non-self, actually you have to get rid of all that stuff. And that was basically Navoi's teaching. Huh? Was always through the beauty in meditation, getting a chance to see what desire is. Huh? Desire is, we still see desire as something desirable, huh? Something beautiful. Huh? If I just had this, if I just had that, if this just wasn't there, I would be so happy. And we still believe that the whole time. Huh? If I just had a Snickers, I would be satisfied. If I would just sit next to somebody else, I would be so happy. If I would sit at the top of the line at Ajahn Brahm's place, actually, I could be the best boss in the world. If my kuti was just bigger, if I just had my own shower and my own toilet, and I didn't have to live with the dirty monks in the shower block, I would be so happy. And the mind just doesn't see. It's this wanting and not wanting business. Is this heaviness? There's this heaviness to it. Right? And there is, in that direction, there's just no happiness. It's just more control. Look at the people with, if they control more than anybody else, like the dictators or whatnot, huh? Where you have to, there was that, what, I don't know if it was Hussein, I think people had to take a shower and put on fresh clothes and I don't know what before they could see him, that he doesn't have to get any smells he didn't like. Was he a happy guy? I don't think Saddam Hussein was a happy guy, actually. Yeah? There was a tremendous amount of control there, but this holding on to that amount of control, what a headache. What incredible amount of suffering. This is this big backpack having this bricks on your shoulders and carrying that around. And so the direction is opposite in Buddhism. It's not having to have, not having not to want, but not by telling the mind all you shouldn't want. If the mind still sees happiness there, then that's the happiness the mind needs. Funny thing, or not so funny actually, but interesting. In war, people dying around you, you don't have enough to eat, incredible stench in the air, people cannot wash themselves, you have decaying bodies lying around, the most disgusting, I don't know if you're in contact with decaying bodies, I just had to transport a dead kangaroo again recently, and it's the worst, actually. It just makes me physically sick. It's this gag reflex coming up. It's sort of is not a proliferation in the mind. It's something that hits you directly in the senses, and the body reacts. So with all this horribleness around, the biggest increase of children is usually in a time of war. When it's the most disgusting, the most unwashed, bad breath and bad body odor and stench all around, that's when people hop into bed with each other. And why is that? Why? Because the suffering is so great. And the greater the suffering is, the more the mind looks for happiness. And what we usually come up with is sex and drugs and rock and roll. that is actually where the mind goes. That is what the mind knows. Food, sex, sleep, or any kind of entertainment. But usually it's sex and food are the biggest ones. When that's why we all get the big bellies when the sex drive goes down. The 50, 60-year-old men, actually, they usually get the bellies. That's where it goes into the food. So the mind, wanting the mind and forcing the mind not to see happiness where it still sees happiness is just such a stupidity. But showing the mind that in that direction there's only limited happiness, showing the mind, but look, there's also danger if we try to make everything perfect in our surrounding. If we really take the pullover and we take the mosquito spray and we take a bottle of water, or better, 5 liters of water, because we might get stranded, and then we have enough water if we're there. And we have to carry all that stuff around to feel safe. So it's good to know what is reasonable, what is unreasonable. And beyond that is luxury. And as being in robes is easy because you have the 4 requisites. You need food, you need medicine, and when you're sick you need clothing, and you need a shelter. That's what you need when you have a body. That's where nobody can disagree with that. If you want to get away from being too uncomfortable the whole time and fidgeting around because it's just so unpleasant in the body the whole time, then you need these 4 requisites. It's just the way it is. And that's why the monk have the 4 requisites. But the people still bring food that is seasoned. It's not that they bring food that is completely without any taste. Well, some do actually, but can't do anything about that. But usually people try to make nice food, actually. Why is that? Should monks not basically be beyond something like that? Why do we get cake? What is cake good for? What are all these sweet drinks good for and stuff? That's not something you need, is it? So what are they trying to do? Keep the monks in samsara? I mean, there is a sort of a realization there that the path is obviously not trying to deny yourself everything. Getting away from desire doesn't mean basically I'm trying to force my mind being free of desire. It's seeing danger where danger is, and seeing happiness where happiness is. Seeing the limited happiness of a Snickers bar. Gone. That's the happiness of food. If you watch it, that is the happiness of it. It's yum, 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 yum. Maybe if you're lucky, you have a 5 to 10 seconds aftertaste. Happiness of sex. It seems to be very exciting and special in the moment, but when it's gone, it was just tension and tension evaporating, and then where is it? Where is it gone? How much is created around these things, food and sex? And then maybe these little status symbols, a fast car or big house, a swimming pool, or I don't know. People get their happiness from maybe power over others might be a point as well. But power over others, if you look closely, how much suffering that is if you have to control. The more people you have to control or try to control, the more suffering you have. It's just exhausting. If you know a little bit of meditation, who can want to be the president? I mean, you have to be completely crazy wanting to be the president. Having that kind of responsibility and demands on you for other people, or stuff you can't control in the first place, is madness. I can't understand it. I'm sure the presidents are not meditators, actually. It's impossible. So seeing suffering where suffering is, seeing that this more power is not more happiness, more power is usually more suffering. Something better here and there, if it's necessary, nice, and might make your life easier, but how far does it have to go? How fast does your car have to be? How big does it have to be? How big does your house have to be? How much stuff do you need in there? And I mean, if you make it beautiful and you enjoy it and whatnot, that's all fair enough. But also watch very clearly when things become a burden. When you have the first scratch on your new car from some other idiot with a keychain, or I don't know what happened, or your first accident, or I don't know. So this having something, losing something, having and losing is one thing, it is suffering. In that game there is suffering. And if we know that, we don't put all our cards into that game anymore. And then we have an idea through Buddhism that the Buddha describes something more beautiful, where that game stops. Where this instead of trying that direction of more sensual pleasure and more happiness, we can try getting the right amount of sensual pleasures, not to suffer too much, but developing a mind that appreciates and delights in this moments where it realizes you don't need anything. If you have these moments in meditation, or maybe just a few seconds, where it's just like you're there, or everything is exactly like it should be. It doesn't need to be any different. And that delight that comes with it, that security that comes with it, that feeling of independence, not to be thrown around by this process that we can't control in the first place. is a completely different kind of happiness. This happiness of something falls away and it's lighter. It's not something coming towards you. It's always something dropping away. And it's just lighter and lighter and lighter, and that's and the mind can if it gets a taste of that, that is one of the good addictions of the mind, because that is the mind that is inclined to letting go. And if we haven't experienced that, we have to watch a little bit closer. Maybe it's just a second, maybe it's just half a second. But we train our minds already in a way that we identify happiness, we identify suffering. We see, oh yeah, this is anger. Did anger ever lead me to more happiness? No. Does anger prepare me that makes me strong enough to push through my own agendas? No, I don't need that. I just need a clear mind. That can the more clear my mind is, the better I can express myself. The more I can take the other person into consideration and maybe say something that helps the situation. And not just try to make me feel better. And maybe even takes the other person aboard and we find a better solution. That needs a clear mind, a calm mind. So that is when the best decisions happen. So it's 24 past, another 5 minutes. I want to give you the opportunity, if you have comments or questions to what I said or to anything else. Thank you, Ajahn Chittapalo, for keeping it real. Yeah, very helpful. Oh, it just goes down my shoulders like oil. And now a negative one, come on.
Thank you for your honesty. Yeah, so the same thing.
You're welcome.
Also, I just thank you for your honesty for that talk, and also about the burden that life feels like a competition to sometimes for me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But. It is a burden, isn't it? If it's competitive. Competitive is no pleasure.
Yeah.
And the more the mind sees that, the more it's inclined in a different direction, and that's the beauty of it. I mentioned it in many talks before, we don't need anybody in the background that still tells us, oh, this is wrong. If the mind sees this is more the direction of more suffering, it's already inclined away from it. And that is, for me, always people in Buddhism, I don't know if you have heard the term Nibbida. Especially in monastic circles, they make a big fuss about it, you know. Oh, Nibbida is the pulling the mind away from that what is unwholesome, pulling the mind away from sensual pleasures, pulling the mind away from greed, hatred, and delusion. But the Buddha actually gives the simile of a feather towards a candle. What does a feather do when it comes too close to the candle? It just shrinks away from the candle. So it's not the active act of, oh, I have to pull myself away, Nibbida, and Nibbida towards that, and Nibbida towards women, and asubha, loathsomeness of the body practice as much as I can, and whatnot. And then people get very negative and their life becomes very miserable, actually, and especially in the monasteries, you have that a lot going on, and people coming new to the monastery and staying in the monastery, that's they think what they have to do, restraint and nibbida. But it's when the mind sees their suffering, it shrinks away. It's a natural process. There's no miracle behind it, and there's no will behind it or anything. It's just seeing clearly, nothing more than that. If the mind sees where happiness is, it's going to incline towards it. That is what the mind is. It wants happiness and tries to avoid suffering. So the clearer we see where the problem is, actually, the mind will little by little draw away from that. Huh? Old habits die hard, but it's a process.
There's a question.
There's a question in the chat box from Christina in Japan. Could you help with how to handle
unfulfillment in life? If I just knew. Well, you just ordain, and then you can really see what unfulfillment is. Unfulfillment. What do you want to be? What do you want to be fulfilled with? Is the first question. Is there an idea in the mind of something out there that is going to fulfill you? What is that supposed to be? Like I said before, some people they get still married and they're 80 years old. Actually, they still think it's going to be happiness in that direction, just having another partner again. That's just their life, having a partner, having their dream partner, and then they're going to be happy. And even if they're old and ugly, actually, they can't accept the fact it's over. And the happiness was never in that direction. That's why so many people suffer in their relationships, because they think their partner is going to make them happy. No, it's not. I guarantee you. If you're not happy in yourself, your partner is not going to do it for you. And putting a child into the world is not going to make you happy. If you're unhappy before your child, you're going to be unhappy after your child. Actually, the fulfillment, this ideas of something out, putting something out there into my life, and then there is fulfillment. The word is so wrong in itself already. Full, you're full with something, but everything that is full is going to be empty. We eat and then we defecate, and it comes in and out, actually. We have a relationship and there's a honeymoon period, and then it's gonna go down, and the sex goes down, and maybe you, if you're lucky, it's going to be a good friendship when you're older or whatnot. But it's never going to fulfill you, your partner. Being rich is not going to fulfill you. So nothing out there can fill you up, and then you stay full. You're going to be full and you're going to empty out again. Love, hate, happiness, suffering. Seeing this in the sensual realm, it's this movement. That's what we have. We have impermanence. In Buddhism, so maybe first you have to get that concept right, what you want in your mind, what the mind still fantasizes about that is going to make you happy. Ajahn Brahm says, as one of the good ones from Ajahn Brahm I find is, oh happiness, to see that there is no bliss anywhere in this world. How can that be happiness? Is he just sarcastic? No, it's this funnily, this realization that this things that are ascribed happiness to in the world, so, and the ultimate happiness, the only happiness that is, a little bit of happiness, fair enough. If we're honest, there is happiness in the five sense pleasure, is there? Otherwise, we wouldn't go for it. But to seek fulfillment in that direction is hopeless. I think the only thing for me is this idea of an abstract goal. because that goal of even the goal in Buddhism after 20 years, it is not completely clear. Maybe the direction is a little bit clearer. But I haven't experienced it, what the Buddha is talking about. But my mind can see clearer actually that in that direction there cannot be happiness, there cannot be fulfillment. In that direction is happiness and suffering. That's the senses. The senses are based on polarity. If we have something for too long, it vanishes, it goes away, or it becomes uninteresting. So we need this change of things even to perceive happiness. So they go together, happiness and suffering. And in that direction there is no fulfillment. Fulfillment in Buddhism is realizing what is leading to more happiness and what is leading to more suffering. And by realizing that, we relinquish more and more of that goal that somewhere there on the outside is going to be our happiness. Somewhere there in the future is going to be the perfect girl for me, freeing me of my ropes actually, and we have the most beautiful sex again, and it's going to be lovey-dovey forever after. Oh, I can cook my perfect meals myself again, actually. Don't have to eat that stuff, actually, that I don't like, and whenever I want to. These fantasies that we create, I mean, my circumstances are obviously different to yours, but in a way, that it's similar. It's all sense pleasure stuff, and there's no fulfillment there. The fulfillment is in the direction of finding happiness inside of yourself, finding happiness in these moments where the mind realizes that is what is happiness. Happiness is not wanting anything. The mind wanting fulfillment, wanting that safety in the future somewhere there that it doesn't exist. Wanting something that doesn't exist cannot be fulfilling, it can just be frustrating. So finding happiness in this, seeing this movement, and seeing this thing sometimes that falling away a little bit, getting a little bit lighter, feeling a little bit more independent in your own mind. That is a direction I can encourage you to go, where the mind sees where happiness has a possibility to grow and where happiness is just impossible to prosper, and that is seeking all your, putting all your cards in the sensual realm. But there is a realm in the mind where it is becoming more and more beautiful, and it's becoming more and more independent. And if you're talking of fulfillment, and if we use that word, then that is a direction to take, but not another ascribing it another idea and another word, because then we're just putting it into this restraints again, and then it becomes wanting and not wanting. And what is happening in the meditation when something's happening is always this contentment building on contentment, building on contentment, building on exactly where you want to be, you know, exactly where you want to be, and that in-breath is exactly good enough, and that out-breath is exactly good enough, but not telling you that, obviously. It's something that is happening, hopefully, in your meditation as a real experience. And that is a direction where suffering just becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, and it's this abstract goal. I call it abstract goal because it's not concrete for us yet, and that is for me a direction that can give you maybe enough hope as well to give it a try. And even if you have frustrations on the way, you'll hopefully get some of the sugar on the way as well that you can keep going. And if when that direction becomes clearer, I hope this idea of fulfillment become clearer as well, that that is a concept in the mind and that makes you suffer already. Just having that idea of being fulfilled, needing to be fulfilled, is suffering already.
Thank you, Ajahn. We need to draw it to a close for this evening.
Yes.
And
you're welcome.
Saying thank you very much in the chat box to you.
Thank you. Thank you also, Rachel. You always keep it very light and happy. Thank you very much for your input. You all have a good night. Sleep well. Treat yourself well.
Thank you.
Okay. Good night. Bye-bye.